This is Carl Robinson, June 10th, 1991. When Psyches Do the Tango, Conflict, Healing, and Growth in Relations.
June 10th, Jungian lecturer Carl Robinson, When Psyches Do the Tango.
Before we get started, I do want to say those 3x5 cards, please keep them handy. I don't want your names on because I want it to be confidential, so just keep them handy there. I'd like to get an idea first off, and there's a reason for this, and I'll explain in a second, but I'd like to know why people are here. I mean, what brought you here this evening? Would anyone be willing to be brave enough to raise their hand? Please.
I'm writing a book.
So we have a professional here. Anybody else brave enough? What about tonight's topic specifically? Anyone else? Yes. Really need title. We're learning about how to write titles here. Yes. Now, the reason why I asked this is that I gave a talk about 4 years ago. I was asked to give a talk on, the title was called Understanding Masculine Psychology. And it was to a public affairs forum. It was not psychologically related. And I gave this talk, and then about this many people. And afterwards, the program director came up to me. She was very, you know, visibly disturbed about the whole thing. She came up and said, "No, this really wasn't what I was expecting." And what did you expect? And she was kind of embarrassed, but she said to me, "Well, I thought you'd kind of tell me about how to go about getting a, anyone can fill it in, a date, getting a date." So I've learned that I better find out what people are expecting here. This isn't about getting a date, but it is about relationships. Now, I'll tell you why I'm interested in this subject in particular. It's actually kind of strange that I would be, given my background. When I was younger, I fancied myself to be, I guess, well, how would you put it? I wouldn't exactly say a loner, but I certainly saw myself as this kind of existential, deeply thought, introverted type person. I don't know what else to say. And I thought that the whole process of what I would call consciousness, I mean, becoming more conscious and growth, required a classically introverted process. I mean, when you think of analysis of any type, I think people think of an introverted sitting, laying on a couch, or, you know, sitting one-on-one always, deep, 4 times a week type thing. And that was my notion of it. And that all completely changed for me when I went to work with kids. And I went to work in the middle of the desert, as Kate said. I was 19, very naive, very idealistic. And I worked with these kids that, actually I went there as a counselor of 19, visualize this, this is a kid that's in college, thinks he knows a lot. And the person who was running the program said to me 2 things. He said, "I want you to put away all the books that you're reading and don't read a book. You will learn everything you need to learn from these kids." And, well, okay. How about that? And then he said another one. He said, "They will save your life." Now, I didn't know what that meant. I mean, I thought my life was okay. But it was true. But it wasn't an easy process. Let me tell you this. Working with kids that are juvenile delinquents and what we label as crazy, one of the nice things about them, which is also the difficult thing about them, is they have very little to lose in their relationship to you. And so they would say exactly what was on their mind. And what they often said, what was often on their mind, was the very things I didn't want to hear about myself. Which is one of the key things we're going to be talking about tonight. And they were point blank with it. And, you know, kids have built-in hypocrite meters. That's the only way I can put it. They know it. They see it. They detect it, and they let you know it. So I went through a very difficult 2 or 3 years with these kids until one day I kind of woke up. I'm not sure how. Maybe I was on my back on the ground or something. We played ball a lot, very rough football. And I realized, you know, I got to stop trying to be the counselor and just be me, which meant be me with all the faults and all everything else. And there was a very strange change, because once I stopped trying to act like what I thought I was supposed to be, the kids stopped giving me a hard time. And that really taught me something. I mean, it brought me out of this... it's hard to explain how it really affected me, but it did in such a deep core level. It brought me out of this real introverted process and just said, you know, this isn't so bad, being with people. And that was a very strange thing for me to feel, to know. The other event that really brought to me very important, how important relationships are, of course, is the relationship I currently am in with my wife. I've been very fortunate to be with someone who was able to balance off things with me, but not be willing to take on unnecessary burden. Being willing to say, no, that is yours, this is mine. And be also willing to say, recognize that she has her stuff that she's putting onto me too. And be willing to communicate that with me. So through my relationship with kids and with the relationship with my wife, I've learned to really appreciate relationship. Now the work I do isn't strictly couples work, but I'd say probably 50 to 60% of the people who come to see me, the problems or whatever they present when they come in, they say something to do with a relationship problem. So I think that's a major issue. And obviously tonight, the size of my body, I think that people will find this to be an important subject matter. Let me give you a couple. Just want to state my agenda and where I stand in relation to, quote, Jungian psychology. I was trying to think of how to label me. And the only thing I could come up with is neo-avant-post-Jungian. I mean, whatever that is. Meaning, what it means is that my roots are in Jung, but I'm in probably the trunk of this tree, but I branched off a little bit, and the blossoms are going to be here tonight, hopefully, and then maybe I'm really hoping there'll be some cross-pollination here tonight, and I can learn some things. Actually, how I was brought into... finding out about Jung was by happenstance. I was in high school in my senior year back in 1968-69, and I was in physics class, and my physics teacher, Mrs. Wilcox, who I will always be indebted to, gave us an assignment, and the assignment was to do a book review of a biography of a scientist. And I went to the local bookstore to look through the biography section, and I was looking through there, and I came across a book that had dreams in it, in the biography. And I pulled the book out, and here's this guy on the front. This is one of the older editions, and it's this man with he didn't have this thing on it, but had his glasses on his head, with his head a little cocked over here, a little smile. Have you seen this picture of Jung before? Well, I looked at the title, and I looked at the picture, and I'm thinking, well, this isn't so bad. And then the fact that his name was the same as mine, Carl, so you don't, and then I figured, well, what the heck. So that's how I picked up Jung. And I took the book to my physics teacher and I asked her, I said, this isn't a physicist, but will it do? And she got this big grin on her face. and said yes. So that was my introduction to Jung. I put Jung away for about 10 years after I read that, and along with all the other books, as I mentioned earlier. And I came back to learning more about him as a result of a dream. And this was a dream that no one could explain to me except for communion. So I thought, well, I better start reading this stuff again. So anyway, let's get on to the program here. The agenda tonight. We're going to look at a few things. I'm going to write these down just so you can have them. And I'll post them up here. I like doing this. I do this mostly so I don't forget. We're going to talk about the individuation process. And, which equals, I'm saying, consciousness. Let's move on. And we're going to look at vulnerability. And power. And we're going to look at complexes. So what I'm going to talk about, we call them sub-personalities. And bonding patterns. And last but not least, at the very end, if we have some time, and I hope we do, I'll talk a little bit about a process called the voice dialogue method, which is I've found very interesting and fun and helpful in this whole thing. What's going on? Dialogue. And I'll put this up here. Now, my style of talking, I'm not a lecturer by trade. I'm mostly a clinician, so I prefer to interact with people. So if you have, at any time, you want to ask a question or you have an idea, I'd rather you would say it. And because often what I find is that it doesn't really veer too much from the plan of action. You know, some people are very concerned that if you let people interrupt, what's going to happen is you're not going to stay on the agenda. That's not my experience. We usually stay right on the agenda. I can get this to fill out. So I don't forget. Now, before you get tainted by what I'm going to say, the 3x5 cards you have, if some of you don't have them, then just, you don't have to do this. And I don't want you to write your names on this, but I just like you to use them. And those that don't have the card, just sit there with this information and just think about it. What I'd like you to do is to write down on there, with just very few words, like maybe one word descriptive things, how you would describe yourself to others. If someone said to you, describe me, and describe yourself, you know, just write down a few descriptive words. Like, if you're writing a play and you want to describe a character in the play, just a few of those words. And now, another spot in there, just one more thing. I'd like you to write down what ticks you off about others. You know, your pet peeve. You know, if you think about it for a moment here, somebody that, you know, when you're in a group or you're someplace and someone ticks you off, and what are the things, or what irritates you? It doesn't have to be angry, but what are the type of things that irritate you? Just write a few things. You don't have to fill the whole page up. Maybe all night, you know that. Three or four things is all we need to do. And when you're done with that, I'm going to ask you to please not sign it and please not change it. And just hold on to it. And later on, I'm just going to have you pass them in because I'm going to use those. Now you can hear erasers. See, that's why I didn't give you erasers on those things. Don't erase anything. I want to tell a little story that'll help as a metaphor for tonight's work. This is, it's actually not my story, but it's a story that maybe some of you are familiar with. Anyone here, how many people here have read The Odyssey? Good, a good crew. Oh, wow. Well, I only read it a few years ago, but there's, I didn't read the whole thing. I only read one part that was interesting to me, and that's the part I'm going to tell you. If you remember, Ulysses is on a journey. He's basically lost, and he's trying to find his way back home to wherever that home is. And on one of his layovers, he lands on an island with his crew, and they're out of provisions, and I don't remember the name of the island, it doesn't matter, but there's this island. And out in the distance, they see smoke rising, and it's apparent it must be coming from a campfire or something. So Ulysses sends his first mate and some of the crew to investigate. And so they go off, and they go out to find this, and they come upon a cottage, and they can see through the window of the cottage that there's this woman there, and she's cooking a brew, and they're very hungry, these men. They've been without food for a long time, and she sees them and comes out and invites them in, and they are eager for this, and they run in. But the first mate stays out. He's a little bit more wary. He's been taking lessons from Ulysses for a while. And he stays out. So the men go in there and sit down at this big table. And this woman, her name is Circe. Circe feeds them. And as they eat, the next thing that happens, they turn into swine, pigs. And she shuffles them off into her corral out back. And the first mate is aghast, frightened, and doesn't know what to do, and runs back all the way to the ship and tells Ulysses. And Ulysses, being the good captain, he knows what he has to do. He has to go rescue his men. So he takes off and tells them, wait for me, I'll be back. Don't worry about me. I have to do this on my own. So Ulysses takes off. And along the way to this cabin, this little hut, there comes out of nowhere this little creature or person who is known as Hermes. People here know what Hermes is, the myth. For those who don't, Hermes is this little god that happens to, Jungians tend to like Hermes a lot. He's a trickster, and he has all sorts of knowledge. Interesting things for people to know, and he plays tricks, and he knows all the crafty things in the world, some of the magical things in the world. Anyway, he stops Ulysses and says to him that if you go there, you will be turned into swine like your men, but I have a potion that can help you. And he tells him, and he gives him this potion. He says it's called Molly. It's made out of an herb. And he says, you must drink this potion before you go inside, otherwise you'll be turned into a pig just like a man. And Ulysses says, okay, great, and starts to go off, and Hermes calls him back and says, no, you can't go yet. There's something else you need to know. You can't just take your men from her. You need to, give very specific instructions to her. You need to force her, one, to release your men. And then he says, then you must stay with her and learn from her. There's something you need to learn. So Ulysses goes off and goes to this hut. And Circe sees him, comes out, and bites him in. And when her back is turned, he downs the molly. And he goes in there and sits down to this fine meal and eats it and doesn't turn into a pig. In fact, what he does is he pulls out his sword and he puts it right to Circe's throat and says to her, release my men or I will kill you. And she says, oh, please don't. Please, I'll do anything. And so he agrees to let her live. And she turns his men back, the swine back into men. And the men feast And what happens is that Ulysses decides to stay there for a while. He ends up becoming her lover. Spends about a year with his men on this island, replenishing and getting ready to go. And then he's off onto the new journeys. Anyone know where he goes next? He goes to Hades to visit the lost soul, to learn from the dead. Now, I'll refer back to the story as we go on, because it's very much what we're talking about tonight. Before we do that, let me just go on to the next point here. I want to give credit where credit is due tonight. So what I'd like to do is to read to you a few quotes from Jung and from a couple other people. Now, these quotes are going to be talking about some of the basic material tonight. I'm going to give them to you because I want the words from these people to be in your mind, but just to mull them over a little bit, and then I'll expand on them. I'm not going to use them verbatim, but I just like them to kind of inform you and to stir you a little bit. This is Jung speaking, and this is from the Collected Works, Volume 8, anyone interested in reading it. He defined a conflict. Can you still hear me? All right. Define a complex as an image of a certain psychic situation which is strongly accentuated emotionally and is, moreover, incompatible with the habitual attitude of consciousness. This image has a powerful inner coherence. It has its own wholeness and, in addition, a relatively high degree of autonomy. Complexes are living units of the unconscious psyche. Here's another one. Complexes seem to form because of the tendency of the psyche to disassociate or split in the face of intolerable suffering. Splitting ultimately derives from the apparent impossibility of affirming the whole of one's nature. The existence of the complex throws serious doubt on the naive assumption of the unity of consciousness and on the supremacy of the will. Now, the next couple quotes are from two analysts from San Francisco, John Beebe and Donald Sadner. This is from a book called Union Analysis. It's edited by Murray Stein. I'm sure they probably have it out there. Complexes are like real personalities in that they contain images, feelings, and qualities, and if they engulf the ego, they determine behavior as well. They are caused by conflict, and they are injuries to psychic wholeness. Yet once formed, they tend to press for recognition and integration by the ego. Splitting, which we talked about earlier, is a normal part of life. Initial wholeness is meant to be broken, and it becomes pathological or diagnosable as illness only when the splitting off of complexes becomes too wide and too deep and a conflict too intense. The way back, the restoration, perhaps always partial, is the work of individuation. The nucleus, the dynamic origin of every complex, is connected to the inner directive center of the collective unconscious, the self, the ego. This connection to the self introduces a paradox. The production of complexes not only leads to a divisive injuring, but also provides a new way of achieving integration. Complexes participate in the self's effort to replace an initially unconscious state of unity with a conscious state of wholeness. Their dual nature explains that splitting, even to the point of psychic injury and neurosis, is necessary. in the evolution of consciousness and the ultimate personality integration. This is contrary to Freudian ideas of repression, which contend that the contents of repressed complexes were once conscious. According to Jung, this is not so. Some of the contents of complexes may have been conscious and repressed, but many of them have never been conscious. These enter the psyche from the collective unconscious as fresh archetypal images moving toward consciousness. The concept of the complex in analytical psychology does not lend itself entirely to the usual medical model, in which illness is regarded as an unfortunate interruption in the patient's state of wellness. In the Jungian model, the patient must endure the illness in order to become well. The illness contains some of the germs of wholeness. And then lastly, this is paraphrasing, but John Perry, another Jungian analyst, he spoke of complexes as being bipolar. Sounds like they need lithium, but it's not the case. Furthermore, he believed that the bipolar arrangements of complexes form the structure of the psyche. All of its complexes are arranged in complementary pairs. Okay, that's the heavy stuff. Because that's hard. At least I find it hard to translate. But I wanted to give credit, because this is where this stuff comes from tonight, basically. And what does it all mean? Now, what I'm going to use to explain it is someone else's work a little bit, and a little bit of mine, because I find using the word complexes to be a little cumbersome. It doesn't have, for me, a bite. I just can't put a handle on it. What is a complex? It just floats around there a little bit. So I'm going to talk. I'm going to draw a lot tonight from two psychologists. One's a former Jungian analyst. Now, if anyone wants to know why he's former, I'll tell you later on. But anyway, Hal Stone and Sidra Winkleman. And they're authors of a couple books, two of which are out there if you want to see them. This one's called Embracing Each Other, Relationship as Teacher, Healer, and Guide. And I did some training and work with them when I was in California. And I like kind of the way they present things a little bit. It's easy for me to understand. So let's go back to this whole thing. What am I trying to get to here? I like to rethink of complexes as subpersonalities. Now, some of you maybe have heard a lot lately, especially if you listen to John Bradshaw's work. Any of John Bradshaw? He talks about the child, the vulnerable child within. Well, that comes from Jungian stuff. And a lot of his work also comes from these folks, because in fact he gives credit to them on the back of the book here. If you can think of a complex as a living unit, I mean, it's there. It's alive inside of you. A subpersonality. Now, John Perry talked about them as being bipolar. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so let me draw something to make it easier to see. You can imagine when you're very young, a child being born. A child is born and we would like to think whole and complete. Children are extremely vulnerable. The word vulnerable, but the vulnerability. They're very vulnerable and they're completely at the mercy of the world around them, their parents, others. And to survive, they learn very quickly that certain things that they do or do not do are okay with their parents and okay with the environment. This is probably very simple for everyone to understand. They figure it out. They're very smart. They find out what is okay with their parents, what isn't okay with their parents. But what happens? That, when they start to do that, they begin to deny certain parts of themselves. That's what we talk about splitting off. They begin to deny that certain parts of themselves exist. Because if they were to allow those parts to be there, to be available, they would be criticized, they wouldn't be accepted. You can think of all the countless different things that parents and society does to keep down, to ensure that wholeness or the person, the kid being exactly who he is, isn't going to be, isn't okay. So what happens is that the kid begins to formulate certain parts, certain ways of being in the world, and develops what I would call, what we would, might call complex, but let's say begins to develop sub-personalities that are unique to himself, him or herself, and are there to protect them. To be able to not be vulnerable, children very quickly learn power. They learn what it takes to be out of vulnerability to go into power. They don't want to feel that way, so they develop ways to handle situations. Let me give an example. When I was preparing for this talk, I started having lunch with various people here. I just do this all the time anyway. But I was having lunch with people who are members of society, etc. And people were telling me about what they wanted from speakers. And one thing I need right now is for the windows to be open. Is it hot in here? Can we open the windows? I will speak up. Let's get back into this thing again. Okay, see, I was going to give an example of me, which is the best way I can do things. I was preparing for the talk. I started having lunch with various people, and they were telling me all the things that they like and do not like about the speakers here. Keep in mind, I'm preparing to talk. And, you know, I would hear various things from them. One person said to me, you know, I really like this one person, but this other one, you know, he always talked from the hip, and it was just sort of ethereal, and I didn't like that too much. Then another person said, you know, the person I like the most, you can guess, I'm sure, is the person who presented this didactic lecture. I even had one person say to me, can you tell some jokes? And, you know, they're always so serious, and, you know, I'm paying attention to that by bringing this here. Various different things were happening. And I started at that moment to feel, I mean, not that moment, but over a period of time, I started to feel a little heaviness come over me. And my wife noticed it. And I forgot to bring the card. About 2 weeks ago, my wife gave me this card. And the card on the front was a joker. And on the inside, it says, life is mysterious. Don't make it too serious. This is one of the things she gives to me every now and then. Brings me back to consciousness. But before she gave it to me, I was stuck. I was really in the thick of it. I was really just heavy, and I had become very serious. Now, that serious quality that I can get at times is there to protect me. I developed that a long time ago. In fact, I remembered how I developed it when I was preparing for this talk. It completely escaped me. I remembered when I was 7 years old. Seven or eight, because it must have been seven or eight. I used to go to a day camp in Arizona and in the summertime, and they had this theater, small little theater, probably no bigger than this, maybe a little wider, that they used to put on summer productions and things like that. And I got this notion, I'm just a little kid, this notion that I was going to put on a play, and I was going to write the play, and I was going to direct the play, and I was going to have everyone be in the play. And I got all these other kids, and they said, yeah, I'll play, I'll be in this. And the day of the performance came. Now, mind you, I didn't prepare a script. I had fully expected that they would know exactly what to do. and that they would just follow my lead. Well, they did follow my lead, to tell you the truth. Because what happened was, is I got the day of the performance, and it's just the rest of the camp and the staff, and there may have been 20 people out in the audience, and seven, eight-year-olds on the stage, and I had a little bit of a storyline going, and then it just disintegrated. I mean, it was pitiful. These kids went every direction but up, and I just stood there, and I realized what was happening, and I can remember it distinctly. I remembered it just being deciding at that moment to be really serious. You know, that the way, just, this will never happen again. And I could just, you know, I could look at people in the audience and look there and just remember thinking, look at them and sort of stare them down kind of thing. I won't do that to you here. I'm moving my eyes around. I want to get you in my stare. If I get you in my stare, you really feel it. But I sensed that at that moment. Okay. So I did that. I learned to be serious at that moment to protect myself. That we would call a complex. I would call one part of a complex, I'd call subpersonality, and I would actually call it a very primary one, primary part, because it's of major importance to me. And it came into my life to protect me. All of us develop these type of ways of being in the world, not necessarily being serious. There are various different ways of handling it. Some people, I remember a client from San Francisco. By the way, whenever I mention that I'm talking about a client, I'm making very sure that I'm hiding any possibility of knowing who the person is. I'm only talking about people in San Francisco, and I kind of change things a little bit. This is to protect confidentiality, and I think it's important you know that. I remember a particular client who, the way that he dealt with things, he was 27 going on 13. And the way that he dealt with things was he became just this little kid around everyone. He was very powerful by being incompetent, by being helpless, by not holding a job, by being troublemaking, you name it. And that was the way he acquired power. He had everyone run circles around him. In fact, at 27, his parents were still paying his way. There's a variety of different ways that people develop these, what I would call, primary selves to protect themselves. And it's all in service of protecting what we call the ego. That's us. You know, whoever, I'm just going to use that term today to describe the whole part of us is, we'll say, the ego. Now, under ideal conditions, if things had been different when we were young, and if we didn't have to hide parts of us, we would have available to us a wide variety, a great potential of various ways of dealing with the world. This is the kind of a key point I'm going to get to tonight, is that we would have a lot of different sub-personalities. Remember when I talked about this thing that splitting is inevitable and way back to wholeness and a couple things like that? One of the notions in how Perry also talked about that complexes are bipolar arrangement, the complex form, the structure of the psyche. The theory I'm presenting, part of the things I'm going to talk about tonight, is that we're really a composition of a variety of selves, a variety of sub-personalities, tons of complexes floating around, and that and what happens though is that we learn to use only a very limited supply of them. Imagine an orchestra. Think of the conductor as ego. The conductor would hopefully be able to call on all the different players in the orchestra to play the music that belongs to this score, which is, we might put under the category of big self. And under ideal conditions, the conductor can call on every part. But what happens to most people, it happened to me, is that I learned to listen to only a few players in the orchestra, and in fact what happens is that those few players get to be so strong that we get them confused with the ego. Yes?
I'm thinking about some of the things that we learn from others is that the responsible get. That's okay when we are always working toward receiving this expected response.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we maintain the formula that we know how to receive the expected response. We can do this because we know like our parents or whoever is okay with that response in place. So we end up just building certain tunnels that we go through in certain ways. So what if we step out and do the opposite of something, the chaos or the unexpected?
Well, that's...
Is that the trail that leads to?
Yeah, well, that's the trail. That's where I'm actually headed. Okay. What she was saying, did everyone hear what she was saying? You know, basically, we're getting tunnel vision. You know, limited amount of resources. We end up using only a few players in the orchestra. And we learn over a period of time to continue using those, but there's a quirk here. And this is where one of the key things about Jungian psychology, this whole idea of the individuation process, we really want to be whole. We don't want to be split off. And so what we end up doing is that we get into situations where we get a chance to bring back into us the parts of us that have been split off, which is going to be leading us into this whole thing of relationships, which is what we're here for tonight, because that's the whole big thing tonight. We have an orchestra, we're limited, parts of us are split off. We don't get to use everything in us. Some of it we don't like. We, in fact, disown it. Different parts of us are disowned. We push them away. But the necessity and actually the drive for wholeness puts us into situations where we are going to get the chance to learn and get those things back. And that's what I think a great deal about what relationships are all about. Part about falling in love, I'll be right with you. Falling in love, for example, or just being in relationship, for example, is we get attracted to people, or we get involved in situations with people who carry the disowned parts of us. You ever get, when someone says they fall in love, they say, I found my other half. You know, I feel complete. Those type of phrases. Well, what happens in love is that we, for a very wonderful period of time, get to be in a relationship with someone where we do not have to feel vulnerable. When we first fall in love, we tend to feel like everything's going to be wonderful. So when we're not vulnerable and frightened, we get a chance to to remember and see the parts of us that we're missing. Because the other person is there and likes us and sees us, and we get to feel this. Now, two things happen in relationships, I think. One is that after a while, the magic of love tends to wear off, and we tend to abdicate our responsibility, and we end up going back to the old way, and we end up being in relationship with the other person, with them again holding the energy that we're missing, and we end up being the way we were before. So what happens then is classic stuff. I'll give you an example. I'll give this example, then we'll take a little break because it's hot, and I know you got everyone here needs to take a little break. This is a client I used to work with, and once again in San Francisco. And this gentleman was the classic provider. He was a very high-powered salesperson, sold big-ticket items, you know, type of things that when it came to closing a deal, it took 6 months to a year, made a lot of money, and he worked 50, 60 hours a week, had two little kids, six and seven. His wife was a housewife by choice, by agreement. And she stayed at home, and he made a living. This is classic, you know, traditional American model that's going and getting outdated very quickly, at least in my family. And one day, this has been going on for 7 years, one day his wife leaves him a note. She'd left him. She'd left him for another man. And so he came into therapy about a week later and deciding he better look and check this thing out. And what we discovered over the period of time is that this man had taken on the role of being the provider. The wife had taken on the role of being the dependent person. They had balanced each other out. But her need to be whole interrupted. But because their relationship was so strong, the bonding, this is what we call bonding pattern, was so strong, she couldn't get through his stuff directly. She couldn't say to him, I need to be, you know, develop myself more. In fact, when she once said to him that she wanted to get a job, he said, why? I make enough money for both of us. So she learned to quiet, you know, just shut up. So eventually what she had to do is bring chaos into the situation, throw it all into disarray, and force each of them to look at what they had to do. Now, in this case, it's pretty obvious what these two people had to do. The male had to learn about vulnerability and about dependency. He had to learn to give up power. That's frightening because that meant he had to go into a vulnerable place where he could be hurt. She, on the other hand, had so long been in this dependency role that in many ways that was her power side. So for her to become powerful was placing her into a vulnerable state. So she had to go about her business of learning how to be powerful so that they could once again be in relationship. And in fact, that's what they did. Now, why don't we take a break and we'll come back and I'm a person so we can learn about what we need. We get drawn to another person, and love is about being drawn toward the person where we get the possibility of re-owning our missing parts. Now, the other thing that happens, which is probably of interest to you folks too, because I didn't want this talk just to be about romantic relationships, and I hope I made that clear in the blurb. We get involved with people, whether they be friends, bosses, co-workers. We get involved with them too, because we're trying to learn, we're trying to grow. And one of the things that often is the most difficult teacher is that when we get into arguments or when we get involved in a situation where we are unhappy with another person. Now, remember those cards I had you fill out? Would you mind just sending them to the center aisle and then sending them forward? Just pass them on forward, and we'll... The beginning is because I didn't want you to be tainted by my discussion and try to alter things to make it sound like, you know, you're a wonderful person or all those type of things. But I obviously no one signed these, so I don't know who it is. I'm going to shuffle them just so you know. I'd love to be Penn and Teller. Anyone here ever see Penn and Teller? The magicians, they're wonderful. They always tell you how they do the tricks. You still can't figure it out. Okay. And this whole thing about vulnerability and power, we want to stay in power. Doesn't have to be a bad and, you know, derogatory term. It just means we want to be safe. That's what power is all about. We don't like being in vulnerability. We stay in power. But, you know, in certain circumstances, various times, when we're working, when we're just doing things in general, we sometimes get into a vulnerable state. We don't like being there very long, so we race back very quickly into the power area. How you can find out, you know, I talked at the very beginning about we develop maybe some primary subpersonalities, the ways that we tend to protect ourselves the most. Well, those are generally the things that if I were to ask the question, you know, how do you describe yourself? So, for example, this looks like mine. Serious, but very personable. Now, well, that part I don't know about, but practical, fun. This is a description of what might be the primary subpersonalities in a person. Now, the vulnerable areas were the ones that I said, would you describe what ticks you off in other people? This is the part we call the disowned parts, or what we sometimes call the shadow, what we project onto other people. And this person said, intrusiveness, know-it-all attitude. Some of these I can't read, this one's other. Here's another person, outgoing, complicated, friendly, enthusiastic, strong-willed. That's a description of primary selves, primary subpersonalities. The, what would probably be the disowned parts are extreme extroversion. That's what ticks them off about somebody, boy. Okay. Closed-mindedness, unfriendliness. I'm not going to go through all, there's 50 cards here. Believe me, I'm not going to go through them all. I just wanted to get people thinking. Here's a good one. It's just good because it's different. Not good because it's special or anything. Spiritual war, how do you pronounce this? Warrioress. Yeah, that's right. Spiritual warrioress. Searcher. Adventurer. Earthy. Sensual, aesthetically oriented. Those are primary self. That's how this person sees himself. What pet peeves? Lack of humility, vulnerability. Don't take responsibility, accountability. victim, I think constant victim is the word, and no color. That's interesting. I don't know what that is. Well, I just want to throw a couple of those out. When we, to be able to have this orchestra available to us, you want to say something?
Well, you're describing Christ as what?
Yeah. Remember I was talking about things that we split off from ourselves when we're kids? If we would take a look at the psyche as a whole, the psyche as a whole, under ideal situations, would be both extroverted and introverted, for example. You know, familiar with the yin and yang, the symbol yin and yang? Anyone here not? I'll draw it if you're not. One of the interesting things about it is that often people miss when they're looking at it. There is the totality of the self, who we are, we could say is represented by this symbol. If you notice here, there's, it's the opposites, but the seed of the other is in each. Often people miss this little thing that this is a dark spot here and this is open here. Symbol for the seed of the other. So coming back to what you're asking is that if we were taking the totality when we were born, we have this marvelous orchestra that has potentials for everything. So it would have potential for not only being a spiritual warriors, but also having a lack of humility, a victim, earthy, sensual, outgoing, complicated, extreme extroversion, introversion, the opposite, closed-mindedness, openness, all those possibilities are in that. But for whatever reason, how we were raised, certain things, if you want to look at behavioral, certain things were reinforced. And we learn to be in power, to be able to be, not feel vulnerable and at risk. We learn to pay attention to certain things. So for some people, that means being extroverted, for example. For other people, it means being introverted. For me, it meant being serious at times. And at other times, I'm learning how to be funny, I think, or at least silly. Hermetic, that's a good one. Robert Bly tells a story about Sitting Bull, that when Sitting Bull was meeting with all the chiefs and they were discussing very important plans and it got too serious, what Sitting Bull would do is leave the tent and then come back in backwards with his pants down. They usually change the things. Heard that one before? Okay. So, to be complete, this whole idea of becoming complete, we get attracted to people that carry the energy, whether it be good energy or this disowned energy. So we get invariably, it seems like it's an unwritten rule of the universe, that we will inevitably be attracted to people or get involved with people who carry the disowned parts of us. This is why, for example, in romantic relationships, you get people who divorce and they go out and marry the same person again, just different color hair. Yeah, it's the split off part. It's the part that was not okay with the world and that you learned that you better hide, or why we'll talk about putting your sack.
Survival.
To survive, you put these things out of sight. You disowned them. I don't think any of these things are negative, except in the extreme, when they get out of hand. You know, but one person might say something is negative and one person might not. But one person being extroverted is, you know, they don't like it, like this person said. So we get attracted to people, or we get involved with people, in either case, that carry this energy. So we keep getting involved in the same things over and over again until we learn, until we are able to bring some awareness in and be able to have a relationship with this disowned part. When I was earlier and I told the story about Ulysses and Circe, the metaphor is that he had to learn something from Circe. He had to spend time with her. She was an enchantress. She was a witch. He had to learn about keeping cards on the table. He had to learn a number of things from Circe. He had to develop a relationship with her and integrate what she had, and then eventually he had to move on. He did leave. Yes. You're right. This is the next thing. And this is a very key point, and thank you, and you're right on schedule here. Got this. This is what we call archetypal images, archetypal bonding patterns. Give you an example. I worked with a guy once who was involved in the environmental movement. And he told a story about when he was arrested once during a protest and went to trial. And there was a whole bunch of people who were arrested together, and they were sequestered and brought in, and they stayed there. They were in court for 3 or 4 or 5 days, and they'd go on breaks, and they all were sitting together and talking together, people he never knew before, and there was a woman there. And he was happily married, this guy, but this woman and him, he kept talking, and he said, I knew I could just feel this thing come over me, like I became attracted to her, and I just felt really big, and I mean, he was describing this feeling of just like pumped up and all sorts of things. And he knew that he didn't want to have a relationship with her, but he couldn't quite figure out what it was. Well, we could say in his case, he was involved in kind of what we might call the hero journey type thing. That's an archetypal image. Something universal, it seems to be repetitive. If the potential's there for it happening over and over again, there's certain types of those images that go on. There's a lot of different, that's why Jungians often talk about all the different myths and stories. The Ulysses thing. Ulysses is an archetypal journey. Probably why this myth is, the story has lasted for 2,000 years or more, is that it touches core issues that are in all people. It didn't die off. The story didn't get shoved away because it had images and issues that were universal. So an archetypal bonding can take place. So with this guy, he became this hero, and this woman was with him, was looking up to him. He talked about her, just kind of looking up at him, and he just felt this coming over him. Yeah. See, every hero needs someone to look up to him. And this is part of the bonding patterns. One of the classic archetypal, this is, you know, some people say this is biological, but that's part of what we could say is a classic archetypal bonding pattern is parent-child. Each of us has been Well, there's a couple ways to look at it. Within each of us, we carry a parent in us. And in each of us, we carry a child in us. That would be the basic philosophical point of view in the Jungians to take. It's all part of this orchestra. We carry a child, we carry a parent too. Now, in romantic relationships or any really close relationship, the parent in us will bond with the child in the other person. And the parent in them will bond with the child in us. So what that would look like would be, you know, parent, child, and you have another one of these things going on like this. So the parent, the child is very vulnerable. It bonds with the parent in the other person. The child in this person bonds with the parent in that person. Now that's fine, and that happens all the time. And like I said, this man, the hero, happened. You have the hero and the, what would you call the person that's the worshiper. Now, I'm certain there was a kind of reverse thing going on with him too, but he was had more strength for some reason. Now, this is a key point about conflict and healing in relationships, is that if this stays unconscious, or in the case of that gentleman, if it stayed unconscious, he would end up in a really bad situation. He doesn't want to have an affair, but if he didn't have some awareness, develop awareness, get an aware ego, he might very well end up where he shouldn't be, at least according to him. I'll give you an example. When I gave the example of the man who had the classic traditional American family, okay, in his situation, he was acting like the parent, we could say, to his wife's child. And now here's a particular situation with him. One time he was under a lot of pressure, his sales were down. It had been like 4 or 5 months since he closed the deal. Very much concerned. He was beginning to feel vulnerable. Okay? And he didn't like feeling vulnerable. But he didn't have any awareness about what was going on. So what happens, he went home and he was sullen and quiet. And his wife, who has been so used to being a very good daughter, child to his parent, father, all related to him like she normally does. Just talking, you know, fix him a drink and say, hello, honey, how's the day? And he just was real sullen, very unconscious about what was going on. He didn't say anything. And then the rest of the evening went by and she put the kids to bed and then came out and he started snapping at her and said to her things like, you know, all you ever do is spend time with your friends and you don't do any, you know, you're leaving the house a mess and blah, 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 and all that type of thing. This got her, in her case, what happened was that then she became really guilty, whiny, kind of sorrowful daughter to his father. She just locked in really quickly. He became more powerful, helped him take care of his vulnerability. She went real quickly into being the very, very good, guilty daughter. And it took the tension off. See how that happened? It just took the tension away. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't last forever. And what happened was fortunately, it didn't last forever with him. She didn't know how to talk to him directly. He wouldn't allow it. And he also was so unconscious to what was going on, he just couldn't talk to her about, he couldn't come home. The ideal situation would have been to come home and say to her, you know, honey, it's been a rough week. You know, I've been spending, the last 4 months have been a shit. And I'm not, I'm feeling like I'm not going to have my job, I'm scared. I could use some help. I just need you to be there for me. He couldn't do that. He was unaware. So instead, how he took care of himself was by being, rushing into the power side and just beating her. And then, and he didn't do it physically, but just basically, you know, emotionally. And she went into her good daughter and felt badly about it. And so eventually all she could do is have an affair to get out of it. Now, that's a classic bonding pattern. How do you get out of all this? This is what we're trying to get to tonight. How do you get out of this? I think everyone understands it. Okay. Now, remember I talked about the conductor of this orchestra? Okay, that we'd like to call the ego function. That's what I think everyone in psychology, every form of psychology, they'll talk about ego being this executive function that sort of decides what to do. Where I'm coming from is a little different slant. It's in that thing, but I think for most people, what they consider to be ego, who they are, you know, like these straightforward, down-to-earth, witty, warm, retrospective, that's what most people would call their ego. You know, that's me. That's who I am. I would tend to say that that is more or less a constellation of those primary cells that are existing over here someplace, and it's an unaware ego, you could call it. So what we need to do is to somehow bring awareness in here so that the person, his conductor, can see that they have many, many more self-personalities, self, whatever you want to call it, other options to choose from. Now, and so they can do other things. They don't have to just always be these primary ways of dealing with things. Now, how do you do that? Well, that's primarily, if you ask any analyst or anybody that does depth-oriented psychology, that's what the psychological process is all about. It's bringing things from the unconscious, the vulnerability stuff we don't want to look at, and bringing them out into consciousness. And the way you do that is in a number of different ways. You talk about it. You talk about what's going on. You talk about your dreams. What the theme about tonight is that through relationships, you can see the parts that are hidden, that are disowned. That when a person goes into a therapist's office, or they don't have to just go there, but let's say that, they come in and talk about difficulties in relationships, and they say, I got an argument with my boss today, or I got an argument with my next-door neighbor. Every time they talk about that argument, or they talk about, you know, someone is, you know, ticks me off, or anything you want to talk about, that's information that's food for us. That's the clues to the disowned parts. That's how we can begin to learn what we need to pull back in. So instead of just pointing the finger at the person saying they're a bad person, most people want to go into therapy first, and I'm certainly do it to this day myself anyway. You know, when someone ticks you off, you point your finger at them, and you tell, you know that old saying about three fingers pointing back? You need to look back at yourself and realize that probably what's ticking you off a lot about the other person is that they've touched into something in you that you don't like. Sure, there are people who do things that everyone won't like. and should be disowned. But nevertheless, for the most part, a lot of what goes on in relationships is the arguments and the difficulties has to do with parts of us that we need to become aware of. So by dealing with the difficulties and talking about the problems that happen in a relationship, you do have a potential, the chance to learn about yourself, learn what you need to take back in, and to re-own so that you can complete the picture and become whole, which is, quote, the individuation process. You can't become whole exactly, I should say that. It's a never-ending process for two reasons. One is that we're really vast, and two, this thing that you've mentioned about archetypal stuff, there's things always emerging. There's more coming all the time. So we're never going to be complete. We're always learning. Now, one of the ways that I have found it's fun and interesting in this process of gaining awareness is a method called voice dialogue. And it was developed, as I said, by Hal Stone and Sidra Winkleman. And it derives from a number of things. Obviously, the major focus is pulled from the Jungian theories, which we're talking about. But it also takes some lead from Gestalt psychology and psychosynthesis, some Buddhism thrown in. A number of different things. I think those are the major ones. And maybe a little bit of psychodrama, if you want to put it in there. But what these people did is they formulated a system. And what they actually ask you to do, it's interesting, is that they suggest that you have conversations with these missing parts. Now, if any of you are familiar with active imagination, have you heard that? Okay. That came out of Jung's. He, I find the quote here. Well, I'm going to throw these away for now, I think. There was apparently Jung back in 1913 when he was working on this whole idea of complexes, etc. He was writing and he heard this voice say, "This is art." And he said, "What do you mean this is art?" He said, "No, this is science," when he was talking about the work. And the voice said, "No, it's art." And he started having this conversation back and forth, and he ended up doing it on paper. And that was the development of active imagination. And basically, it's a process where you try to have a conversation with these disowned parts. That was the part of him that was trying to tell him that it's not just science, it is art, the stuff we do. It was also a feminine voice, and Jung had a lot to do with re-owning his feminine. In fact, if you were here to hear Peter Mudd talk in December, he talked about Jung and the split feminine. But anyway, this is kind of a derivative of active imagination. But the difference is that we really try to bring in awareness, because when Jung was talking back and forth, the part that was talking was his ego, which had identified with the power side of him. He didn't have awareness. So it took him a long time before he could integrate this split-off part, because he had this unconscious part talking with an unconscious part, if you can understand that. Okay. So this voice dialogue process kind of works like this. I wish I could demonstrate it. Actually, there's someone here that knows it, but there's a facilitator and the participant, the subject. And what the facilitator does, the facilitator is someone that has a little bit more awareness, a little bit more practice. Doesn't mean they're perfect. Doesn't have to be a therapist, but it's been someone that's been trained a little bit in this. The facilitator will engage the other person in a conversation but we'll talk specifically to these parts. And we'll begin with talking to the main parts that this person has identified with their ego, which we call primary subpersonalities, primary cells, whatever you want to call them. Or another way to talk about them is being the protectors, the part that protects you. And what happens is the facilitator will talk to this person, if I could pretend here for a moment, that this lady is a subject. And I would ask her, if I would say to her, could I talk to the protector in you, the part of you that protects you? And I would actually have her move someplace. This is sort of gestaltish. Most people know about gestalt therapy. And she would move to somewhere in the room or wherever she felt like that she could be the part of her that protects her, or one of these primary parts. For that man, it would be, I'd like to talk to the part of you that's the provider. I'd like to talk to your provider. He knows that. He's used to that. That's where his power is. And he would move, or in this case, she would move, and I would engage a conversation with that part as if it was a real human being, like we said earlier. Subpersonalities, live images, real entities. Talking to that, engage in a conversation to find out what it does. Without, hopefully in my position here, without criticizing it, without judging it, getting to know it. To have an awareness, to develop an awareness of this. So we get, I have this conversation, and then I would probably, this is only a very brief introduction to it, but I would then, I might ask to talk to another part. Another part that I might have sensed that this person used. When we look at these, the cards here, now this one, I might say to him, I'd like to talk to your down-to-earth part. Or I'd like to talk to your witty part. These are the primary parts of the head, the big ones here. Or I'd like to talk to your introspective part. And we get to know that part. We talk to it. And then this is a, kind of the interesting key thing about this, is when we're done, I would have this person stand up, and I would be sitting down, but I have them stand up next to me, and I'd ask them to just stand there and without judging, from a place of being a non-judgmental witness. And I say to them, just look at this and just be aware. And then I talk about the parts that we talked with. And I'd ask that person there, in the state of awareness, to feel into, for a moment, each one of those parts. I take one by one. To feel into the, for example, this man, I want you to feel into the provider. Notice its energy, size, weight, a number of things. Just be aware of it. And I talk about some of the things I learned. Then I ask him to let go of that awareness. And then I'd say, now feel into this other part. And we'd go through that step also. And then this is a key. Then I'd ask him, take that awareness with him and sit back into the first person we were talking to, this menagerie here, which would be the ego, the person that came in the door. Now, describing this has none of the flavor of it actually happening. It's very hard to do that, but I personally have gone through this process, and other people, my clients, have gone through it, those that like to do this. I don't suggest everyone do it. they report that they actually have a feeling of these separate personalities. And they can bring this awareness back in. And then by having an awareness, this is a key. It allows you to disengage from the bonding pattern. See, when we're caught in it, when people say, I'm caught in a complex, that's when they're unconscious, they're stuck, they're in it. Yeah. For this person, it'd be their own, probably started in when they were kids. Actually, complex is the whole kid and caboodle, and that down-to-earth part is one half, the bipolar, the one half of the complex. The other half would be the opposite of down-to-earth. I would eventually. Now, the reason why, because at first you have to make friends with all the protectors, because they're there for a very good reason, to protect. And I would get permission from them before I talk to the other part. Because they got to know that I'm not going to disrupt this too much, and that I'm not going to take away all their defenses. But the interesting thing about this is that when you bring awareness up here into the ego, it enables the person to disengage more quickly from bonding patterns. If this man had awareness of his vulnerability, he might have been able to come home and say, I'm vulnerable, I'm feeling at risk, rather than being caught in it. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to eliminate these things. Now, it's very important to understand you never, ever eliminate complexes or subpersonalities. We're filled with them. They're there forever. You just might as well make friends with them. The Greeks used to say you had to honor all the gods. You know, you can have your favorites, but you got to honor them all. And this whole business about awareness is really developing the ability to see our patterns, to see the primary ways that we deal with things, the primary ways we stay in power, and then to learn more about our vulnerable areas, and to be able to disengage more quickly, and to enable us to have an ego that is aware and can choose. See, there's the next step, which would be wonderful, is to be able to choose our options. I hope that I could choose to be a little bit funny at times, and to choose other ways of being in relationship with another person. It only comes about through developing awareness. This is just one technique, one way. I think I've covered all the basic things tonight. Question, I don't think it's always that easy. That's why we have to do all this work and spend all this money to do stuff. It isn't that easy. Yes. Which is how we learn about the missing parts. And then you need, generally, an objective observer around to help you develop that awareness. There's an old African proverb that says, even the sharpest of knives cannot scrape its own handle. And thank you very much.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.